Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie, a PhD student at Northwestern University. Today I'll be speaking with Douglas Irwin about his fantastic, broad-sweeping new book called Clashing Over Commerce, A History of U.S. Trade Policy. It was published in 2017 by the University of Chicago Press. Irwin is the John French Professor of Economics at Dartmouth and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Scholars haven't always found tariff policy to be the sexiest area of research. One historian said that the tariff has caused narcolepsy among his colleagues. But today, as the Trump administration ratchets up a trade war with China, and along with other countries, they cannot deny its significance for party politics, the global economy, and international relations. In Clashing Over Commerce, Douglas Irwin resists the seemingly soporific qualities of tariffs and trade policy, and he shows how they have been at the center of so many of the major crises in U.S. history, from 1776 to the election of Donald Trump. He turns tariffs and trade policy into a novel history of the Republic itself. Most remarkably, Irwin writes about highly technical matters in pleasant and thoughtful prose, so that even an economic history dilettante like myself can follow along. The book should interest economic historians, scholars of American political development, and historians of U.S. foreign relations. I hope you enjoy our interview. I'm speaking with Douglas Irwin about his new book, Clashing Over Commerce. Thanks for being on the show, Doug.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. And so I really enjoyed your book, and I'm very thrilled that we are speaking today about it. And so before we get into the book's arguments, I'd like to discuss the basics of trade policy. And so just to get us started, what is trade policy and why do people care about tariffs?
Well, so the way I think about trade policy is we have to start with the fact that most countries engage in international trade, and international trade is a two-way street. So countries export some of their goods and services to other countries in exchange for imports of goods and services from elsewhere. So you have to keep that in mind, that involves both exports and imports. And then when we think about government policy, that involves either trying to subsidize or encourage an activity, or trying to tax or discourage an activity. So that sort of gives us a two-by-two matrix of you know, trade is exports and imports, policy is either subsidies or taxes. And when you think about those four, export subsidies, export taxes, import subsidies, import taxes, and then you look at the American historical experience, it really comes down to import tariffs being the most important one. The Constitution actually prohibits export taxes, so we take that off the board. We export subsidies. We do have an export-import bank. It was created in 1934 in the Roosevelt administration, but it's never been really big, and we haven't been a big subsidizer of our exports. Import subsidies, most countries, in fact, I can't think of any country that's really subsidized bringing in foreign goods. And so that leaves import tariffs, which is really where all the action is in terms of trade policy. So why is that? With international trade, there's exports and imports, but there's also sort of winners and losers domestically. So some groups benefit from exporting. Other groups are harmed by imports, by foreign competition. And so they have in the past lobbied the government for higher barriers against imports so that they can raise prices and increase their domestic output. So you're reshuffling in some sense income and jobs whenever you change tariff rates. Whether you raise them or lower them, there's going to be winners and losers, and there's always a political fight over exactly what a country's trade policy ought to be.
Americans care about the tariff. But as you show in your introduction, tariffs have not been the most exciting topic for scholars, historians and economic historians alike. You have a quote from one historian who wrote that tariffs are extraordinarily uninteresting things unless related to the political events which give them meaning. And then you have another who wrote that tariffs had produced narcolepsy among generations of American historians. And so here you come along, wading into this this field of research that people have declared boring, and you write an 800-page book about it. Why have scholars gotten tariffs so wrong? And why do you think they are worthy of scholarly attention?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned those quotes. Those are some of my favorites in the book. I think what one was a political scientist, one was a historian. And so that's where I think they left an opening for me. So I leave it to others and the readers to judge whether tariffs are inherently interesting or not. I certainly think in the age of Trump, there's been a lot more attention to tariffs than there have been in the past. But obviously, when you go in the past, it's been a major issue in the United States, U.S. politics, particularly in the 19th century, but even into the 20th century with the Smoot-Hawley tariff and the Great Depression or the NAFTA debate in the early 1990s. There's always been a debate about trade policy. But I think sort of historians and political scientists, they've dealt with tariff history to some extent. But as those quotations suggest, they're not really interested in the economics of it per se. They're not really interested in some of the effects of trade policy. They talk about it as a political issue or as a historical issue. So I think that's where being an economist gives me a little bit of an advantage, in the sense that saying, well, let's look at these debates, which I think are interesting and have certainly shaped American politics and American government. But also let's look at some of their economic effects. So in the historical debates of tariff policy in the past, there's always been one side arguing that we should raise tariffs because that'll help the American economy prosper. And another group arguing, well, if we raise tariffs, that'll hurt other sectors and the economy will collapse. So the question is, who's right? And economics gives us a way of judging winners and losers and which arguments are historically or economically accurate and which ones are not, and to quantify some of the impacts of the trade policies we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Something that I was really impressed with about or in your book was just how explanation-driven the book was. I could very easily imagine another book on the same topic that goes through the same length of time, from the colonial period to the present, and kind of just throwing up their arms, the author throwing up their arms in, exasperation and just saying everything is complicated. But you organize your material around an interesting and, to my knowledge, surprising thesis that despite how politically divisive tariffs have been, trade policy has actually been remarkably stable. And so I was wondering if you could just share with listeners what causes that stability.
Sure. So if you, I have a chart in the introduction where it just plots the average tariff rate of the United States from 1790, the first year in which we have data, right up to 2016, which is the last time we could obviously do it for today, but 2016 up to the present. And if you look at it, there's a lot of jumping up and down and a lot of variation. And so if you look at that and you say, wow, the average tax on imports is pretty volatile. There must be a lot driving it. It turns out that a lot of that is spurious. And when you look at, for a reason we can get into, but when you look at how the Congress or the president is actually setting tariff rates, first of all, they don't change the rates that often. So I think I calculated that Congress in the 19th and early 20th century only changed the tariff code once every 7 years or so. So it's infrequently changed in that sense. And then when they did make the changes, You know, they weren't radical movements up or down. They were sort of incremental changes. So even when you had a change in the political party in control, and even if they said in their platform that they really disagreed with the existing trade policy, they really wouldn't change it all that much. It was more incremental. So then the question is sort of what's driving that. And so there are a couple reasons for that. One is that you don't have a switch in party dominance very often in American history. You know, if we look at the pre-Civil War period, the Democrats, who were largely based in the South, they sort of dominated American politics in the 1830s to the 18, right up to the Civil War. When you look at the post-Civil War period, right up to the Great Depression, it's really the Republicans who drew their political support from the North that dominated. Not that there aren't some Democratic administrations, but Republicans really were in charge. And then obviously since the Great Depression until the 1990s or so, Democrats really dominated the political system. So you have this political factor of one party largely in charge of things that can sort of set the agenda and set the tariff rates the way they want them. You have economic interests operating in Congress that are very resistant to change. You have infrequent periods in which Congress can actually take up the tariff as a possible legislation. And so that gives a much greater stability than you might think when you look at the sort of the jagged lines of the average tariff rate over time. And if I just one last point on that. So there's these underlying, you know, political and economic and even economic geography features that filters into Congress that keeps policy relatively stable. The thing that's causing a lot of the annual volatility and even sometimes pretty big changes is a very sort of technical point that a lot of the import tariffs that Congress has had in the past are specific duties, which is a specific dollar amount per imported quantity. When we think of a usual tax, it's usually ad valorem, a 20% tax or a 5% tax or something like that. But when you have those specific dollar taxes on particular imports, the ad valorem equivalent is inversely related to prices. So here's where perhaps where tariff policy gets sort of boring for non-economists.
I'm loving it. So that,
okay, makes one of you. So let's say we had a $5 tax on a shirt. Well, if you have a $50 shirt, that's a 10% tax. But if that shirt goes from $50 to $500, then that $5 tax is really low as a percentage of the value of the price. So what that means is during periods of inflation, say during World War II, for example, average tariffs are going to fall, not because the rate is changing, but because the ad valorem equivalent of that specific duty is changing. And then conversely, when we have periods of deflation, when prices are falling, if that $10 shirt falls to $5, that's now 100% tax on that import. So during periods of deflation, average tariffs are going to go up. Once again, not because Congress or the president changed the tariff rate at all, just because of which way prices are going. So that's sort of one thing that members of Congress and the president don't directly control is what those import prices are. And that can account for some of the changes in tariff rates over time.
Hmm. And so you've already gestured to the changes that have happened. So yeah, so you know, you have this thesis about stability within, you know, tariff policy regimes, you know, particular time periods. But you do have some pretty big changes, you know, across the history of the Republic. And you organize it around, you know, a really helpful mnemonic device almost, you know, the three R's, from the country's founding to the Civil War, the government used tariffs to raise revenue. And then from the Civil War to the Great Depression, the government sought to restrict imports to protect domestic producers from foreign competition. And then from the Depression to the present, the government sought reciprocity agreements with other countries so as to lower trade barriers. And so we're going to talk about each of these policy regimes and sort of how they came about. They were each really interesting. And so I want to begin, though, with the colonial and revolutionary period. And so, as we know very well from, you know, the Boston Tea Party, trade was a huge factor in the American Revolution. But you zoom in on trade much more than, many other works on the subject. And so I was just wondering, How does your analysis depart from perhaps more classical narratives about the revolution?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly how much I would differ from the revolution. You know, one tricky question that economists, historians, and political scientists have sort of grappled with is how much of the forces driving the American Revolution and the war for independence was sort of economic based. Did we have an economic grievance with being part of Britain? Or was it a political one where it was just a matter of political power and sovereignty? Or was it some other factors? And I think, I defer to historians who have looked into the period much more in much more detail than I have, but it seems like that you have a lot of different factors factoring into this thing. And that the economic argument is there. And whether you think it's dominant or not, I don't take a stand on that directly, but it certainly is a source of grievance. What's interesting here is that when you look at sort of the when economists and economic historians have calculated sort of what is the burden or the cost of British mercantilist policies on the American economy, how much richer would we have been if we didn't have to send all of our exports to Britain and could import freely from the rest of the world? The total number is pretty small as a share of U.S. GDP. It may even be less than 1%. But the burden was unequal across different colonies. So particularly Virginia apparently was hurt the most due to the enumeration of exports of tobacco. And since tobacco was such a big part of the Virginia economy and a lot of the members in the Continental Congress were directly or indirectly tobacco farmers or their other planters, they took the lead in pushing for independence. So the question is how far you want to push that argument that there was an, sort of an economic basis. And then Britain, of course, I mean, partly the Boston port as being a place where there was a lot of merchant commerce and how much were they aggrieved as a result of British policies. So there's something to the fact, I think, that economics played a role in the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there's a clause or two in the Declaration itself talking about the freedom the colonists wanting the freedom to trade with the rest of the world and the crown having interfered with that. There's also a case to be made that we have the Constitution itself because of the failure of the Articles of Confederation in giving trade policy powers to the Continental Congress. So the trade was very much a part of the colonial economy. We were basically English settlers and other settlers across the, very narrow on the seacoast, gathered around certain ports. So trade was a big part of the economy and economic activity, and it just plays a big role in American history in the colonial and early post-colonial period.
Mm-hmm. So your answer made me think of another question, which is, and this is something you've again already alluded to, but I would just love to hear more about it. So your book deals a lot with geography, political geography and economic geography. I was just wondering if you could just say a bit more about, how this works in relation to the tariff, over the longer period of American history.
Sure, that's absolutely one of the themes of the book on terms of where different industries are located and what their trade interest is, and then how this plays out in terms of politics. So any country, U.S., no exception, obviously, decides politically in its legislature or its executive branch, but for most of U.S. history in the legislature, what its trade policy will be. So that means that the rules of representation are very important for which states and which regions of the country get their stake validated or not by legislative voting. So you have to look, a lot of the book focuses on Congress. That's sort of the crucible. That's where trade policy decisions are really made. Even today, where President Trump has renegotiated NAFTA, there's something called the USMCA, but it really depends on Congress approving it. So Congress really holds a lot of the cards in terms of trade policy. That means the committee system matters, which states have a right to vote matters, and the representation of those states. And then that also depends on the economic interests in those states. How many states are exporting or view themselves as benefiting from the world economy through exports versus how many states and regions of the country feel threatened by trade because import competition will hurt the jobs in that states and incomes in that states, those states. And so one of the biggest divides that obviously historians know very much about is the North-South divide in the 19th century. And that was one based on economics as well in terms of trade. After the War of 1812, and when the U.S. begins to become more of a manufacturer, all that manufacturing was largely located in the North, in New England with textiles and Pennsylvania with iron and glass and things of that sort. And most of the exports were exported crops from the South, tobacco, cotton, and things of that sort. So the divide over trade policy was very much a geographic one, depending on the different regions of the country, and a North-South one. And just to show you how these economic interests can override party interests in many cases, the state of Louisiana in the 19th century and early 20th century was almost always represented by the Democrats. And the Democrats typically wanted low tariffs. They wanted to cut the tariff rates. And if you look at political maps of the tariff votes, it's always South Carolina that's voting against the effort to reduce tariffs. Why would that be? They're a Democratic state. They're going against the party. Well, they're going against it because they didn't want duties on imported sugar cut. The sugar economy was so important in Louisiana. If you're a representative or a senator, you're willing to go against the tide of the party leadership and vote to keep those duties relatively high. So those state interests are really very powerful. They're long lasting. You know, you can go back to the 1820s and representatives from Pennsylvania were very much against more open trade because they want to help out the steel industry. Well, the steel industry is still around today. President Trump imposed tariffs on imported steel. And whether you're a Republican or Democrat from Pennsylvania or Ohio, you probably applauded that decision. So another theme of the book is that these economic interests and the location, geographic location of economic activity, it's very long lasting over time. So we can see a lot of the echoes from the past, even in today's trade politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's well put. And the maps in your the voting maps in your book are just stunning in how they reveal just like how sticky these interests are. You take a map from how people voted on the tariff in the early 19th century versus the early 20th century, and it's almost state by state the exact same.
Yep. Now, and that's what I thought was a really great indicator of the sort of stickiness. I like that word that you used. The fact that certain regions of the country really specialize in certain activities and it doesn't change much over time. And the pattern of trade doesn't change all that much over time. And so you see these long lasting patterns in congressional voting.
And so I want to move on from this earlier period, that was governed more by trade policy for the purposes of raising revenue for the government to the next era, which is oriented around this idea of, restriction. And so how did this transition happen? And what exactly was, what were the trade policy politics of the late 19th century and early 20th century?
Sure. Well, let me just step back and explain a little bit more about this, the three R's, as I put it, the revenue, restriction, reciprocity, because I try to start out the book with first principles about what trade policy is, and then also what the motivation of governments are to impose tariffs on imports. I don't want to presume that it's just going to be economists reading this book. I try to make it accessible to just about anyone. And when you think about why would a country tax imports, basically it comes down to one of three reasons, although all three are in play at any given point in time. One is import tariffs are a tax, and taxes raise revenue. And so as you suggested, before the Civil War, a lot of revenue for the federal government came through import tariffs. That's exactly what the Federalist Papers predicted. And about 90% of federal government revenue up to 1860 was generated by the tariff. So revenue is a very important consideration. The next one would be restriction, where you don't want to raise revenue. You just want to restrict imports to protect a domestic producer from foreign competition, whether it's the steel workers in the 19th century or the auto workers during the 1980s or what have you. And then another motivation for changing your tariff rates would be reciprocity. And there's both a positive reciprocity and a negative one. A positive one, in some sense, is we're willing to reduce our tariffs if other countries agree to reduce their tariffs on our goods. So that gives rise to trade agreements. And then sort of a negative or reciprocity would be when we're raising our tariffs against certain countries because they don't treat our goods fairly or they've raised their goods against us. So sort of that's what we're doing today with China. We think they're not treating our goods fairly. But just because there are these three, each, there's been sort of three periods in U.S. history where each one of these has been predominant. So before the Civil War, it was revenue was really the main driver behind Congress imposing tariffs on imports. From the Civil War up to the Great Depression, it's restriction. And then after during the Great Depression and really to the present day, reciprocity has been sort of the key. So you asked specifically about the restriction period. Well, one question is, why do we get these transitions from one hour to the next? Here's sort of where I invoke exogenous shock. So what happened when we had the Civil War is we redistributed political power in the United States. It wasn't just a war. It's the North really became dominant in American politics. And that just meant that you're empowering a different set of states and you're empowering a different set of economic interests associated with that. And in the North, as I mentioned before, that's where the early manufacturing was in the United States, in New England and Pennsylvania and Ohio and the upper Midwest, upstate New York and what have you. And they wanted protection from import competition. So because the Civil War redistributed political power in the United States, we got a different trade policy where the northern states had more power in Congress and could implement their will through passing higher tariffs.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Great. And so, let's move on to the 20th century. You know, your book is essentially about how the sausage gets made when it comes to trade policy. You spend an entire chapter looking at one particular sausage, the Hawley-Smoot tariff of 1930. It was a really interesting chapter that just showed how policy gets made. This tariff has become infamous with its association with the Great Depression. But something that you show that just really stunned me was how little consideration the policymakers and politicians who are constructing the Hawley-Smoot tariff actually gave to foreign retaliation. You write at one point that the congressional records for this particular tariff ran for thousands of pages. You know, cost something like $131,000 to publish. There were speeches that lasted 20 pages on tomato imports and things like that. But there was almost no consideration that other countries might retaliate with their own tariff. And so I was just hoping that you could talk a bit about how the Hawley-Smoot tariff came about and what it might say about, Americans' view of the United States in relation to the rest of the world.
Sure. It came about because of sort of the depression in the farm economy in the 1920s after World War I. There's sort of overexpansion during the war when we became a big food exporter, and that couldn't be sustained in the 1920s once normalcy returned. And so there's this issue in American politics, because we're still not largely a farm-based economy, it was a big part of the economy, of how to help farmers who are suffering from mortgage losses and bankruptcy and things of that sort. And Congress twice passed in the 1920s price supports, which, of course, we've had in more recent years, but as a way of helping out farmers boost their incomes and raise the prices for the crops they're getting. And President Calvin Coolidge twice vetoed that legislation. But because the farm states were so well represented, particularly in the Senate, They, you know, wanted something to help out their constituents. And so they came across the idea, well, if we can't have price supports or direct subsidy, let's just stop imports of farm goods to help out farmers. And this is a little bit disingenuous because we're, as I sort of pointed out, we were a net exporter of most farm goods. Yes, we imported wool. Yes, we imported sugar, but wheat, corn, cotton, we were still big exporters of. So the idea that an import tariff would really help out American farmers was a little bit far-fetched. But politically, they thought they wanted to do something. Well, once that idea got set and Congress sort of started hearings on a new tariff bill in the spring of 1929, you get what political scientists have identified as log rolling, and which just means that, well, if you're going to vote for a higher tariff on wool, you want to throw in steel as well to get more votes for that. And manufacturers got in the act, and tariffs began to go up across the board when it was really designed initially for the farm community. So you get this rise in tariffs in the House bill, sort of across the board, at a time when this is the spring of 1929, when the economy is doing very well. We have very low unemployment rate. The stock market's booming. Industrial production's going up. GDP growth is pretty robust. So this is the pre-Depression period, and yet they're still passing this tariff bill. Well, the problem is always that it's fairly easy for the leading party or the party in power to get something through the House because there's a lot of discipline. But when you move to the Senate, you know, each senator is their own agent. And so it had been the case in the 19th century and prior to this period that the Senate was always, it was called the graveyard of tariff reform or the graveyard of a lot of legislation because it got held up a lot. And that's where you had speeches on, you know, all day long on the tomato tariff or the clothespin tariff or the iron ball bearing tariff. And literally they're debating the tariff code line by line. And I think there are over 3,000 items in the tariff code at that point in time. So it's just took a long time. It was laborious. Senators sort of looked foolish a little bit to the press because they'd vote a tariff up, and then a couple of days later, they'd reconsider and vote it down because the political coalitions were shifting. At any rate, by the time they passed it, it was the spring of 1930, and we had the stock market crash, and the economy was beginning to sink into a recession. It wasn't quite evident there was going to be a Great Depression quite yet. And then the rationale for the bill changed a little bit, saying, well, we need to now protect manufacturers because the economy is softening. But then, so the whole, it took over a year, about a year and a half to work its way through Congress. And Congress was spending an inordinate amount of time on debating these sort of minute tariff rates. So it didn't do Congress, you know, much. They didn't look good in terms of the public. And members of Congress were very frustrated saying, why are we spending so much time on this thing when there are many other policies we could be considering that would help the economy? So that's how we got it. And you're absolutely right. There's no consideration of what the foreign reaction might be. And that's because if you're a senator from Iowa, you really care about what's going on with corn and imports that might be hurting your constituents. You're not really concerned about whether other countries are going to respond to what you're doing. And so most members of Congress took a very parochial view of what the tariff meant. How does it affect my reelection chances? How does it affect my constituents? They weren't sort of looking up and listening to the world saying, you know, if America passes this, we're going to raise our tariffs against American goods. It just, the Democrats tried to bring it up a little bit, but it just got no traction when you're in the minutia of the tomato tariff or the clothespin tariff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even, you know, President Hoover at one point, you know, when he was facing calls for, you know, some international conference on tariffs and trade policy, he insisted on the tariff being a domestic concern. And I just thought that was just such an interesting attitude to something that, like, very explicitly connects you to the rest of the world.
Right.
Yeah, it was a really fascinating episode. And you laid out really nicely in the book. And so really quickly, things change. You know, you have a changing government, you know, FDR replaces Hoover, and you have sort of the emergence of, you know, New Deal legislation. And something that comes out in, or that gets passed in 1934 is the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act. And it's a really significant piece of legislation in your narrative. It fundamentally changes how trade policy gets done. So what was this act and why did it matter?
Sure. Well, under the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, I believe, Congress has the power to levy taxes on imports and regulate foreign trade. And after having spent a year and a half, going through the tariff code, Congress wasn't really in a mood, particularly when the Democrats took over, to, go through the tariff code again and start reducing rates and trying to undo the damage that had done, but been done by the Hawley-Smoot tariff and the retaliation that had taken place. And so what President Roosevelt and the Democrats decided to do is give the president the authority to negotiate on behalf of the country with other countries to reduce the American tariff if other countries followed suit and reduced their tariff against our goods. And there are various reasons why this is sort of a natural thing. You know, in the past, when, say, for example, Woodrow Wilson came in a Democrat in the 1912 election, what Congress would do is just pass a lower tariff if that's what they wanted. But when you had 25% unemployment in 1933, when the economy was really on its back, passing a unilateral tariff reduction was politically difficult even for the Democrats. And as the retaliation sort of indicates or suggests, the whole international environment had changed for U.S. commerce in the world. So it was really the U.S. stepping up and saying, we have to be engaged in the world. Our trade policies do affect policies in other countries. And if we want other countries to change their policies against our exports, we have to change our policy at home regarding our imports. And so the Reciprocal Trade Agreement Act simply authorized the president to sort of unilaterally make changes in the U.S. tariff code on the basis of agreements that he or she might reach. And this is obviously a huge change from the past where Congress was really in the driver's seat in terms of trade policy. And the president just basically signed whatever Congress passed. Now the president really could shape U.S. trade policy for foreign policy reasons, for national security reasons, for economic reasons. And the Congress was sort of following.
And just moving forward, this is a 900-page book, and so we're skipping over tons of material in our conversation necessarily. So hopefully, we're intriguing our listeners to go and read it themselves. So skipping over, several decades, the 1970s is another moment of great change. The geographic support for each party is shifting, foreign competition is increasingly cutting into American production. And so the post-war free trade orientation in policy somehow remains stable throughout all these changes. So how does this stability persist, even as sort of the economic geography and political geography is changing?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things I try to show in the book that even in the late 40s and the 1950s, when the U.S. economy wasn't facing a lot of foreign competition, when the U.S. really was stepping up and becoming a leader in the world, helping create the UN, NATO, Marshall Plan, things of that sort, even during that period, when you might have thought trade politics would be, if it's ever going to be easy, it would be easy during this period, even then it was very difficult. The 1945 renewal of the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act was pretty tough. In the 1950s, there was pressure from some, once again, some states and some representatives for higher tariffs. So it's never been easy. And it certainly became harder, as you point out, in the 1970s, when the sort of geographic support for the parties is changing as Republicans sort of make inroads into the South and the Democrats solidify their hold in the North. And then it's made even more difficult when foreign competition, which had been in abeyance after World War II because Japan and Western Europe were really flat on their backs in terms of their economy. Once they started exporting again and improving the quality of their exports, that began to interfere with certain U.S. industries. Of course, we're all aware of the auto industry. And that really begins in the 1970s. And so that just makes trade policy even more contentious than it had been in the 50s and 60s and sort of leads into where we are today with debates over NAFTA and trade with China and things of that sort. But I think, once again, the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act really fundamentally changed sort of the direction of U.S. trade policy, and it made it more difficult in some sense for the president to reach these trade agreements. But presidents, to a more or less degree, have wanted to pursue them for various reasons, partly to overcome continued discrimination against the U.S. in world markets. And so there have been pockets of protection, and certain industries have gotten exceptions to the rule. But we've still maintained largely a pretty open trade policy focused on trade agreements, even during the difficult period of the 70s and 80s and into the 90s.
Mm-hmm. As you already know, I'm Canadian. And so, NAFTA, and I'm also, and I was born in 89. So I'm almost like a child of NAFTA, if you will. I was hoping that you could talk about how the debates over NAFTA in the 1990s fit into your larger narrative.
Sure. So once again, nothing is easy in terms of trade policy, either moving tariffs up or down. Let's talk about the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement first, because that's sort of an interesting one in terms of how little the U.S. political establishment really cared about NAFTA, about the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement. So here's this huge deal for Canada, whether we should integrate with the U.S. or not. Huge debate, in Parliament, in the press, in the think tanks, among the population. Everyone's really focused on it. And the U.S., even the U.S. trade negotiators, at the U.S. Trade Representative's office, really, it was a backseat item. They didn't really care. They didn't cultivate much support for it. And I sort of lay out, because there are a lot of great memoirs from sort of the Canadian negotiators about how it almost collapsed and almost failed. And it was Treasury Secretary James Baker who really saved the deal at the last minute by realizing, if we actually don't take this seriously, the Canadians might walk and this thing might fail. So just the perception in the two countries, where in Canada it's a huge deal, in the U.S. it was we almost lost the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement because of U.S. ignorance and not caring about it. That tells you something right there. And then NAFTA comes about because Mexico had some political changes and they want to join the U.S.-Canada arrangement. And that, of course, sparked now, U.S.-Canada agreement was, basically uncontroversial, passed Congress very easily, because Canada wasn't viewed as a threat, a very friendly ally, and what have you. But adding Mexico really changed the trade politics. And I'm older than you are. I lived through the NAFTA debate, it was sort of going back and looking at the debate with the passage of time, almost 25 years. It made me realize how it really has these long-lasting impacts in terms of U.S. trade policy. It changed the way presidents thought about future trade agreements. It changed trade politics and made trade politics much more toxic in some sense in the U.S., much more difficult. One reason, for example, why the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Canada agreed to, the U.S. Under the Trump administration decided not to go into. In fact, a lot of Democrats opposed it as well. NAFTA, very difficult debate in the U.S., a very tight vote in the Congress on whether to do it or not, brought out a lot of labor groups and others against a more open trade with Mexico. We're still living with that. And the same coalitions, pro and con, are still active in U.S. trade politics today.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the more recent politics of trade policy. Your book deals a lot with, the structural factors underlying trade policy, the political contentiousness of it all. How does Trump fit into this narrative?
Well, that's a really interesting question, an important one. I sent this book to the publisher in September of 2016. Right before the election, that everyone was expecting Hillary Clinton to win. And I expected the book would sort of sink to the bottom of the sea. No one would care about it because Hillary Clinton wouldn't raise trade as a major issue at all. Instead, actually, to the benefit of the book, Trump has raised trade issues to the forefront of the policy agenda and really made it controversial and topical. And he refers to history a lot in terms of his talks and speeches. I was able to adjust the last few pages during the page proof period to take into account the fact that we had this new president who had said all these outrageous things about NAFTA and TPP and how trade was destroying us and American carnage and what have you. So that's So the question is, you know, what sort of forecast would I make, and then how have things played out in terms of the Trump administration? So in the book, what I suggested is that, well, you know what, there are these structural factors that you've identified, and I've tried to talk about a bit, that really give the status quo bias. You can't change too much in terms of trade policy. And here's a president who really wants to make big changes. And I think, to some extent, the thesis of the book holds, in the sense that if you look at what President Trump says he wants to do with respect to trade and what he's actually done are very different things. So he did not pull out of NAFTA. And the USMCA is basically this relatively minor rewrite of NAFTA. So not much change there. We haven't changed too much with respect to trade with Western Europe. You know, he has protected the steel industry. Well, you know, President George W. Bush protected the steel industry. Ronald Reagan protected the steel industry. Lyndon Johnson and Jimmy Carter protected the steel industry. That's nothing new. The steel industry has always been very politically powerful and has been, in the past, been able to get new restrictions on imports. So that's not really anything new. Pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, you know, if we had had President Hillary Clinton, she had campaigned on exactly the same thing. And most Democrats were against TPP. So it may not even have been brought up if the Democrats had won the 2016 election. The big change is with China, where President Trump really has, I think, been a game changer in terms of limiting trade with China and having a more adversarial relationship. Although even there, even in the late Obama administration, there was increasing concern about China and the direction China was going under President Xi. So if you were asleep for the past 3 or 4 years and you woke up and said, what trade policy changes have there been? Except for China, sort of nothing too much out of the ordinary and nothing really radical or revolutionary. That may be soft peddling things to the extent that rhetoric does matter. He has President Trump, through his rhetoric on trade, saying we're being destroyed and other countries are taking advantage of us. It really has poisoned the prospects of new trade agreements. It does matter. And he's certainly been attacking the World Trade Organization and sort of led to some deterioration in its effectiveness going forward. So you could spin this sort of one of two ways. One is in the long, you know, tapestry of American trade policy history, there's less that has changed here than one might suspect when we're riveted every day to what the tweet might be on tariffs or what have you. At the same time, the rhetoric has been very divisive, and the administration has not won many friends in other countries with respect to cooperating on trade to lead to more trade agreements. So I think you could spin it either way. And I think a lot will hinge on whether the president is a one-term president or a two-term president. If he's a one-term president, then a new administration can sort of reorient trade policy in terms of where it's been for the past few decades. If he's a two-term president, then we have more trade conflict ahead of us, and he could really change the global trading system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually interviewed several authors who, were just frustrated by, their book deadline kind of coinciding with this very, transformative or this very big change in government in 2016. And so it sounds like you had a very similar experience. The president just kept on moving ahead as, your book deadline remained fixed. So I just have a few more questions that I'd like to ask. And so one is just a methodological question. This is a really big book that covers a lot of material. I'm just wondering, how does one write a book like this?
Well, it was a long work in progress, more than a decade. But, unlike historians and perhaps more like political scientists, economics is really an article-based industry. Most economists just don't write books. They'll just write articles. And I've written a lot of articles over the past 10 or 15 years on various aspects of U.S. trade policy history. So I'd done some stuff in the colonial period and the post-colonial period and 19th century and Holly Smoot and things of that sort. So in some sense, this book was just filling in the gaps and putting those many, many articles in one package. But it's actually much more than that, because the articles are much more economics-based. And I had to fill in a lot of political history to sort of understand where the tariff acts are coming from. And so that was sort of took the time in terms of the research, and it was a lot of fun. So it's the book really is sort of this amalgam of political history, drawing from political scientists and historians, and then economic history, drawing on economic historians, obviously, and then my own work on trade policy in particular. So it's putting a lot of stuff in and just trying to sort of provide a fairly comprehensive treatment of trade policy since the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. And based on my cursory reading of your sources, it seems like everything is publicly available materials, right?
Yep. Because trade policy is publicly debated in Congress, the congressional debates are all in the congressional record. A lot of the data is publicly available. The Tariff Commission or the U.S. International Trade Commission. So it's pretty much above board. Obviously, we don't know what's going on behind closed doors and the influence of various lobbies. But in some sense, what I suggest is, if you're from Pennsylvania, it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you want to protect the steel industry from foreign competition. So how you make your voice heard in a particular administration or in the halls of Congress doesn't really matter whether it's sort of campaign contributions or bribes or what have you. We just sort of know where that representative or senator is going to stand based on the interests of the people of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I thought your book did a really fantastic job of making a case for just dealing with publicly available records, especially for a domain that is so vehemently publicly debated. And so just moving on to, my penultimate question. You've gone through the history of the Republic, essentially, with an attention paid to trade policy. And so I was wondering if you could perhaps say something about the relationship between trade policy and foreign policy in this longer term perspective. For instance, how has this relationship changed, or how has this relationship remained the same? It's a very big question.
Sure. Well, I can just give you a sort of a quick sketch off the top of my head, which is that it seems to me that it's sort of like a U-shape, where when you look in the colonial period and the period immediately after independence and the 1790s, trade policy really is foreign policy. So one of the big debates in the between, say, Hamilton and Jefferson in the 1790s and the Washington administration was, are we friends with Britain or not? Are we friends with France or not? And what sort of trade policy should we have with respect to these countries? And show our friendship or our displeasure with their policies. Trade policy was an instrument to in terms of foreign policy at that time. One example being, great example being Thomas Jefferson declaring an embargo on all trade in 1808, based on the fact that we didn't like the fact that Britain and France were interfering with our shipping while they were fighting each other during the Napoleonic Wars. So our only really instrument for affecting that was trade policy. But then after the War of 1812, really for a long time, trade policy and foreign policy sort of get divorced from one another, because really Congress is calling the shots in terms of trade policy. The president is in charge of foreign policy. I guess historians could say whether we're isolationist or not, but we just certainly weren't very active. And so trade policy really wasn't used in that way. And then with Roosevelt and the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act, the U.S. becomes more active on the international stage, and trade policy then becomes sort of a lever. Certainly in the immediate post-World War II period, we're using trade policy as a way of opening our market, getting other countries to open their markets, solidifying the Western alliance, building strong economies that can resist communism. Certainly that's what President John Kennedy was talking about when he proposed the Trade Expansion Act, which was passed in 1962. And he talked about it in precisely those terms, solidifying the Western alliance and making us stronger. And then when you go to more recent periods, trade policy is still used as a foreign policy tool. We have trade agreements with our friends. We try to have sanctions or limit our interactions with our perceived enemies. And so there's sort of where China fits in too, because there's been sort of this sea change in U.S. attitude and view of China over the past 10 years or so. And now we're sort of separating our economies using trade policy as the way of achieving that.
Hmm. So we're back to the beginning.
In a way, yeah.
Just the final question, the question we always end our program on. What are you working on right now?
Well, having spent a lot of time on the U.S., I've sort of had my say on what's going on, although current events sort of keep me somewhat engaged in what the U.S. is doing in terms of trade policy. But I've really shifted to other countries, particularly developing countries in the post-World War II period, and looking at their trade policies and how they've gone from really being quite economically closed in the 1950s and 60s, when having a lot of exchange controls, overvalued currencies, high tariffs, quantitative restrictions on trade, and sort of one by one, for some reason domestically, being able to find the political will to open up to trade. So Taiwan in the 1950s, Korea in the 1960s, Chile in the 1970s, Mexico and others in the 1980s, and then really from the late 80s into early 1990s, a whole bunch of countries. Obviously, China's a big player there, but India radically changed its trade policies in 1991, as did some other countries. And so I'm trying to understand that process domestically in different countries in terms of how certain policymakers were able to bring about a big change in trade policy that, you know, in some sense, we've only seen rarely in the U.S. Because of that status quo bias, because of the longstanding interests that are in play. How is it that other countries have opened up and led us into this globalized world of today?
Wow, that sounds like a very ambitious project, and I eagerly await to read it. I want to thank you again, Douglas Irwin, for joining me on the program.
You're most welcome. It was a great pleasure.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you, listeners, for tuning in to New Books in History.